From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art.
Welcome to State of Art, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, I speak with author Kim Hecox. He's a former ranger with the National Park Service who has written multiple award-winning books and contributes to The Guardian, writing opinion pieces about the environment and public lands. He lives in Gustavus, but we won't hold that against him. His most recent novel is called On Heaven's Hill. It follows three main characters in a small coastal Alaska town where plans for a controversial bridge and road bring together some unlikely allies. So, you know, a major focus of your work relates to, you know, the environment, conservation, and, you know, maintaining public lands. And I see that you're a former ranger with the U.S. National Park Service. So, like, where did your interest in maybe the natural world take seed to kind of set you on this path that you're on?
I grew up as a Boy Scout. So at a young age, I spent a lot of time outdoors. And in school, I developed a keen interest in the sciences. I had an older brother who was an astronomer, eventually worked for NASA, and then was a professor of astronomy. He would take me out, and I had a couple teachers that blew my mind. In fourth grade, I'll never forget, there was a mural on a wall, a pull-down mural, a large canvas mural that the teacher could reach up with a string on a ring and pull it down, and it would cover the whole wall. And the mural was a painting depiction of a scene of nature, a coastal scene. And all it had written on the mural were one-word descriptors of geologic features. So like mountain, peak, ridge, river, forest, stream, meadow, estuary, beach, sand spit. And I would just stare at it. And I was supposed to be doing my arithmetic, but I would stare at this mural in fourth grade. I was 10 years old. And one time, the teacher caught me staring at it when I should have been doing my arithmetic. And she said, "Kim?" And I snapped up and I went, "Yes, you like that mural, don't you? And what am I supposed to say? Yes or no?" I didn't know what the right answer was, but I nodded. And she said, "Good for you. But right now, do your arithmetic. I'll leave it there for you." So what she did in that moment was she gave me permission to go, to get out.
Fantasize, maybe.
Fantasize, to explore a larger world. In fact, the larger than human world. 10 years later, I took a geology course from a really dynamic professor, and we were in the Flathead Valley of Montana talking about the Ice Age and glaciers everywhere and Glacial Lake Missoula. 17,500 years ago, this huge flood burst through a glacier. And one of the students said, "Why isn't there a landscape just as dynamic in the world today that Montana was 17,000 years ago at the end of the Ice Age?" And Dr. Folsom said, "There is. It's a bay up near Juneau, Alaska, called Glacier Bay. It's public land. It belongs to you. Go." And so I set my mind on getting a ranger position in Glacier Bay National Park. It was then a national monument. And that did it, man. A couple important teachers, Boy Scouts, older brother. There you have it.
Yeah, as a former Boy Scout myself, I've got to say that major impact on the views of the outdoors, environment, conservation, and stuff like that. Yeah, the influence as a young person can't be overstated. You know, what was your experience like, maybe just kind of briefly, you know, as a ranger? That sounds awesome.
It was amazing to embark on these cruise ships that would come into the bay and stand in front of 800 people and talk to them about the importance of public lands. People of all political persuasions and all economic backgrounds, too. Those cruise ships, they're not yachts. You know, the Iowa City Bowling League can be on that cruise ship. And here you have them in the palm of your hand. And you represent one of the most trusted agencies in the federal government. You're a ranger with the National Park Service. They're going to listen to what you have to say. It really helped contribute to my public speaking abilities, mm-hmm. the way I put words together, and contributed to me becoming a writer. And that's a powerful moment for a young kid, 24 years old, new to Alaska, telling America why Alaska public lands are important.
You're kind of like that first step, like introducing them to what they're about to experience.
Why is open space important? Why is the brake on the wheel important? Should we have economic growth forever? Roads everywhere? Should every meadow become a mall? Right? So just get them to think about that.
Yeah.
I'm not shoving it down their throat. I'm posing questions and just asking them to think about what is progress.
Yeah. And the people that take your words to heart, I'm sure, go back to Iowa or whatever and hopefully spread the word, right?
You never know, do you? That's the thing about teaching is you can't measure it. You can't measure the influence you had on that student. Maybe you have a pretty good idea that you really changed them and set them on a new course and expanded their imaginations, gave them the inspiration they would need to reach beyond what they consider their own limited abilities. You just do your very best and do it again and again and again.
How long have you been in Alaska at this point?
I arrived in Alaska in May of 1979. As a 20-something new ranger in the National Park Service, I had arrived from Death Valley, and my roommate had arrived from the Everglades. And he said to me, I've got an old duct-taped double kayak. I'm going to go up the bay and paddle for a week before we enter on duty. I'm going to see if I can kill myself. It's going to be cold, hypothermic weather, winds blowing off the glaciers. It's never going to stop raining. You want to come along? And I went, I don't know. And then I thought, why have I come here? I said yes, and it was the greatest yes I ever said. It was a magnificent trip. He's a dear friend to this day, Richard Steele, retired school teacher in Juneau, Alaska. And I ended up writing a memoir about it, The Only Kayak. It has done really well.
I mean, that sounds like a great way to literally dive in headfirst to what Alaska has to offer.
Right, to push myself and get up here and then have this wild-eyed, crazy-haired guy look like he combed his hair with a firecracker. You know, he's standing there. He had a partial beard. He's young like I am. He's all lit up. He's going to be a ranger in Alaska. You want to go on a trip with me? And I said yes. And it was so great because we'd sit in the rain eating our macaroni and cheese, and I would say something, try to have the Olympian pronouncement about what I thought about the wilderness. And he always had a clever rejoinder, so there would be this repartee between us. And we'd sit in the tent and laugh and hear the glaciers thundering all night long and have whales swim into our dreams. It was very powerful.
I mean, that might kind of, you know, answer my next question, but like, you know, obviously your writing is, at least like your books are very much related to Alaska, and it obviously holds a very important place to you. You know, why the interest in setting your books in Alaska? And, you know, where is that just kind of writing what you know, or what is it about the place that keeps you writing about it, I guess?
I was told once by a writing instructor that you are your own best material. So use it. And Alaska is what America was. It's a second chance. Now we get to come up here with all the reflections of what we've done in the lower 48 and think, well, now what? And that's powerful. What are we going to do here with Alaska? Is it a place for the saving or a place for the taking? And that's profound. It's a deep, deep moral question about what's the right thing to do. I love experimenting with that and creating characters that are caught in that vortex, dealing with each other. And it's profound. Basically, the argument goes all the way back to the beginning of humankind with what are we doing here? What's the right thing to do? And so I like to have moral dimensions in my writing, just hinted at. But, you know, with strong character development and suspense and intrigue and humor and music and all of that, of course, create a strong character so people want to read on.
Well, you know, before we get into your new book, let's talk about some of your other writing really quick. So, I mean, you also do op-eds for The Guardian in addition to the other books that you have written. But what kind of spurred you on to, you know, wanting to start putting stuff on the page? Too many thoughts in your head?
Well, what spurred me on to become a writer is I traveled a lot when I was young. I would spend all my money, and I would often travel alone. I kept a journal, and my journal was my traveling partner. It's my companion. So I would write in my journal about every thought I had, everything I was seeing. And friends read it and said, Kim, you should consider writing professionally. And I thought, well, I want to study the sciences. I know I want to study the sciences. And a professor told me, that's good. Study something other than journalism. Study the sciences so that when you become a writer, and you can become a good writer by being a voracious reader, thinking carefully about the words on the page and how they're done, what is good writing, what is poor writing, and then becoming a public speaker, right? And then working on your writing. Every letter you write, every postcard you write, think about expressing things as well as you can. A little self-deprecation or sarcasm or humor or what have you, right?
Yeah.
And see yourself as a writer. And I thought, well, that's a great thing to do because writing, I believe, is one of the greatest inventions humankind has ever conceived of.
Well, and I mean, coming from the realm of public education and stuff like that, I mean, that's got to be pretty important to have, you know, the hard science people that are, you know, dealing with, you know, stuff that the general public would probably have kind of a difficult time comprehending or internalizing. But to have somebody that can kind of just explain it in either plain terms or in a narrative, that's got to be pretty important in addition to all the other research and things going on.
Yes. Science needs good communication. And science is perhaps the best tool humankind has ever devised to arrive at the truth. Divorced from personal bias and prejudice. How can we arrive at what's really true? You take an idea and you test it. You test it again. You look at the results. You test those. You test them in a different way. You test it again and again and again. So I love science for that. And then the truth, oh, wow. Well, is something true just because you believe it so fervently? All I need are my blazing beliefs for something to be true? No. That doesn't pass the science litmus test. Maybe if it makes you feel warm and cozy, you think it's true and you can sleep well at night. But that's not an objective truth. But the thing about political truths versus objective truths is political truths are much more unassailable. People hold on to political truths ferociously, whereas objective truths, they can be tested and tried and tweaked a little bit because we may not know the truth of something only so well as far as science has been able to prove, right? So we need to come up with better science. Only better science can disprove a scientific truth. So I love that. I love the whole idea of truth, this thing that the word rolls so easily off the tongue. But what is it really? If you read something that really appeals to you, is it true? It could be a fairy tale. It could be a myth.
A poem.
A myth. You know, we live by our myths. So I like to poke holes in that and explore that and shake people's trees a little bit.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, kind of going on to the, you know, like the subject matter of your recent book, you know, tell me about the kind of how you developed the conflict. It's a remote coastal town in Alaska, kind of facing the prospect of a new bridge and road to the community, maybe kind of bringing in outside elements that people won't really be excited about, kind of changing the culture of the town until things kind of come to a boiling point. So maybe this doesn't seem like a totally unheard of situation in our state, but maybe what was some of the inspiration and why kind of frame it around this specific conflict?
Well, the whole idea of roads to resources. Remember Governor Parnell's roads to resources. Oh, what could be wrong with that? Let's have roads everywhere. I know I go down south and I see roads everywhere, and for some reason I like it a lot better up here, right? So the whole idea of that, and I thought, wait a minute. Do we get to the point at some time where we lose more than we gain? So I wanted to explore that. So I live in a small town in coastal Alaska. I live in Gustavus at the entrance to Glacier Bay National Park, where my wife retired with the National Park Service, and we built a home there. Lovely community. And that's the same area that I used in a previous novel, so I know it well. And I thought, love and war, that we, the human race, are capable of atrocities, and we're capable of this magical thing called love. We are really something. So I wanted to explore love and war. So I created a family that's torn up by Danny Nash, who goes over to Afghanistan in the National Guard and gets blown up, loses both his legs below the knees. And I tell that part of the story from the point of view of his preteen daughter. Her name is Kes, short for Kestrel. She's named for a bird of prey. And then there's another character, Salt. He's a trapper who has four sons. And then there's a third character, Silver, a wolf. So the story is told from these three points of view about this proposed road and bridge to be built in the town, a bridge over the river to the far side west of town where there's sandhill cranes, but especially where the wolves live. They can hear, the people can hear them howling from over there. And it becomes a big controversy. And the state's got a reason why they want to do this. The state of Alaska loves to build roads. So is this a good thing? So what happens is this unlikely alliance forms between a group of school children and a band of PTSD war veterans. And they form this unlikely alliance and stand up to the state.
With a batch of unique but maybe familiar characters that, you know, if you've grown up or spent any time in Alaska, I feel like you'll recognize some of these people. But let's kind of talk about those three different perspectives really quick. Obviously, the most obvious of the kind of unique aspects of it is there's a wolf who's, like you mentioned, their pack is on the outskirts of town. And, you know, You do mention some stuff in your author's note about it, which we'll have you read. We'll have you read that just in a sec here. But yeah, let's talk about the process of, you know, getting inside the mind of the wolf, or, you know, the character Silver.
Right. That's a daring thing to do, to write from the point of view of another species. But I did it. And I wrote at the beginning in an author's note, this story in part is about wolves. And while I cannot occupy the mind of a wolf or embed myself in a pack, I can avail myself of many excellent sources that tell me much. We now understand wolves far better than we did 50 to 100 years ago. With each new observation and study, we gain more certainty that wolves and elephants, orcas, octopuses, and other animals occupy much of the same emotional and intellectual landscape that humans do. With this in mind, I have taken literary license to create wolves that possess the compassion and brotherhood they deserve.
So what kind of research maybe went into wolf behavior, pack behavior, getting inside the mind of a wolf for you?
Speaking with wolf biologists, mostly in the Yellowstone area, and then reading several other books. Beyond Words by Carl Safina, Wolves and Men by Barry Lopez. And so talking to scientists and reading the finest books out there about wolves.
Yeah, and I guess it seems like maybe you could have substituted some other maybe animal to be kind of a focal point of some of the conflict. Why wolves specifically?
Well, wolves are a lightning rod in America. There used to be millions of wolves across North America. Now there's not even 1% of 1% of those remaining. There's a hatred for wolves among many people. I imagine I don't think I'm exaggerating to say there are hundreds, maybe thousands of people in Alaska that would gladly kill the last wolf on Earth.
Why is that? What's their motivation?
They're frightened of them.
They
just have a real problem with sharing our world with wolves, or at least allowing wolves to impact our world very much.
Mm.
And they just have this contempt, maybe even hatred for wolves, because maybe they see too much of ourselves in wolves.
They're intelligent.
They're vicious, right? They can be really vicious, lighting into a carcass of an animal they've just killed, right? But they also, it's been proven that they mourn their dead. They celebrate their young. They cuddle up together. They have very soft languages, vocalizations that they do to each other when they're close. I mean, is that love? I don't know. I don't know how you can measure that. But science is looking deeper and deeper into this with elephants that we now know, for example, that elephants have different vocalizations for each different elephant in the group. So they recognize each other by name. They call out their names of each other, right? Same with orca. Orcas perhaps can even detect through the clicking and sonar underwater, can they detect the sex and the size and the rate of speed of another animal? Or can they bounce those waves off the internal organisms and read the disposition of that other animal through the density of those organs? Just like we can read the disposition of another person without saying a word, their eyes, their smile, or lack thereof, right? So I wanted to give wolves that license. And then that allows me at the end of the book to have a tremendous amount of drama as these three characters, Silver the Wolf, Salt the Trapper, and Kes the Young Girl, as their lives come together in surprising ways, exciting and surprising ways.
Yeah, and I mean, is maybe kind of that familial animal element, you know, with their relationships to their groups, kind of tie in with the characters and kind of their familial connections. You've got a guy just trying to raise his four kids, one with a, you know, physical debilitating issue, just trying to, you know, get by. You've got a young girl whose family has kind of been horribly affected by a war. And then you have this wolf pack.
Right, right. This wolf pack that is of a species that has been almost entirely decimated in North America. Right? And do the wolves know that? Do they have some sense of that? I don't know. I didn't address that in the book, but it was exciting and fun to put the wolves in different situations and work through those situations and have this one young wolf at the beginning of the book already be a clever hunter. At one point, the wolf is sneaking up on a marmot, and it's at high elevation, and it's sneaking up. It's on some rocky slope, and it dislodges a rock that starts to roll and make sound, and it stops the rock with its paw and slowly moves it back into place, and then very quietly continues on its stalk of the marmot, just to give it that capability. Well, I heard that story about a snow leopard in the Himalaya that I think George Schaller wrote about, former student at University of Alaska Fairbanks, great international wildlife biologist. And I thought, well, if a snow leopard can do that, because Schaller witnessed it. He witnessed a stalking snow leopard dislodge a rock, stop it, and put it back without a sound. And I thought, okay, I'll have a wolf do that.
Well, kind of, I guess, moving on from the wolves and maybe like the idea of a decimated animal population across the country, it kind of brings me to the character of Salt. You know, he's living in this community, raising his family, just kind of like your normal hardworking guy, just trying to keep things going. But he also seems like he's reckoning with the modern world, a former wolf trapper, maybe kind of struggling to, you know, just kind of operate in an increasingly complex world. He seems like he's a guy who's like got my faith, family, hard work type of a thing. But maybe in relation to the wolves, is it kind of a similar aspect where maybe he is also a species that's dying out across the country in a way?
He is. Right. Trappers. Right. There's not nearly the number of trappers as there used to be. He grew up in Idaho. He loves the outdoors. Trapping was a way for him to spend time in the outdoors. He's not the kind of guy that wants to kill the last wolf in North America. He's not. He respects wolves, actually. And much of his trapping is not for wolves. When he finally moves up to Alaska and he and his wife settle out in the Minto Flats south of Fairbanks, he's mostly trapping beaver. But they live in a cabin. Wintertime at 40 below, they have a son, probably born in Fairbanks, but they have a second son, a third, a fourth. Now the second son, who's approaching 10 years of age, starts to show some physical disabilities. What's wrong with him? He's stumbling as he walks, etc. He's going to end up getting diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is a serious diagnosis. And so then he's out trapping with his eldest boy, Abraham. And the rivers don't freeze up quite like they used to.
Climate change.
He falls through the ice. Abraham fishes him out and gets him to the cabin. And he's in a bad way, and they get a fire going, and they bring him back. And his wife, Rachel, says, or Hannah, says, that's it. We're done with cabin life at 40 below with our three sons. And one of them, there's something wrong with him. So they move back to Southeast Alaska. She was raised in Juneau, but they move out to a little tiny town away from Juneau. And that's where we find him at the time. He's let trapping go. He's become a mechanic. But then a mysterious figure offers him a really good pay to go out and just reconnoiter the area, get across that river. It's a difficult river to cross. Get on the other side of that river and let us know what's out there. The reason being, if there are wolves out there, and if they're salmon-eating wolves, and if they're proven to be a separate subspecies, let's say, and they could be listed as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act, then that's going to cause real problems for the state of Alaska building out there, punching the road out to that river, a bridge over the river, and a road continuing out to that area. Yeah, for development. And the development itself becomes suspicious. They say it's for coal bed methane, but the people know there's no coal bed methane out there. It's the geology is all around. What does the state really want out there? What are they really after?
Yeah.
And that becomes a mystery through pretty much the whole book.
Oh, man. Okay. So one more character. Let's talk about Kes, the young girl who, you know, she ends up moving to Alaska and, you know, just dealing with these kind of, you know, the after effects of her dad serving in Afghanistan. Like you said, comes back with all these horrible issues. But, you know, she's got big, very influenced by her uncle who lives up in Alaska. But, you know, I'm kind of looking at her as potentially the lens to examine all of these various situations that you've talked about, you know, war, love, the environment, just from this kind of, you know, fresh to Alaska, but also youthful lens of, you know, a kid inheriting the issues of climate change.
Yes. Yes. Children are going to inherit our world. And many of them are frightened, overwhelmed. I wanted to create a character to give the children of today and their parents hope. So based on real people that I know, including some Alaskans that are working hard in climate crisis issues and such. So yes, I created a character who the story opens up with the wolf, Silver, and the trapper, Salt. They're both in Alaska. But Kes is in Texas, although her uncle lives in that little town up in Alaska, which is her father's older brother. 12 years older than her father, Uncle Tyler. So it opens up with her, Kes, at the Brooke Army Medical Facility in San Antonio. And there's talk going on about, is it best to amputate her father's legs below the knees? Because he was in a Humvee, rolled over an IED in Afghanistan, improvised explosive device, kaboom. And that's it, man. He's got traumatic brain injury, a wound to the soldier, head wound, and his legs. And he was a musician. He was a magical dad. She loves him so much. And he's shut down. He's not spoken in a long time. They do sign language to communicate with him. And Ty says, bring him to Alaska. It'll let the wildness heal him. Let him plant garden carrots and potatoes. Let him hear these wolves howling from across the river. It's the oldest music on earth. Wolves and loons. So that'll do it, he says. Tyler says to Kestrel, bring your dad to Alaska. Oh, my goodness, that's daunting. So Kes's stepmom, no, she doesn't want to go. But in time, they do. And they arrive, and it's a healing story about how her dad comes back slowly. He becomes a musician again. And it's step by step. And that's a really exciting journey within the book, is to see how Alaska heals him. The yeah. wildness.
Yeah, kind of just the idea of just stripping it all away, going back to the basics.
Well said, yes. Just the primal nature of it all, right? He just stands out on the porch and it's snowing. It's their first snowfall. They've never seen snow like this. And they can hear, oh. And is there structure to the howling? Does the other wolf hit in the flat seventh or the minor third? is there harmony, Papa? She says. And he just lifts his head and allows the snow to hit his face, and it's dark, and they're on the porch, and they can hear it, and he just kind of lifts his head and purses his lips as if he's going to howl, but he doesn't. And then maybe a few weeks later, they hear him humming. And then they see him clipping the fingernails on his left hand, meaning, is he going to play the guitar again? Right? Because he leaves the fingernails long on his right hand to pluck the strings. And just slowly by slowly, he comes back, and it's really exciting.
I mean, I guess before we move on to some other stuff, I mean, do you have personal experience with, you know, the healing power of the state, you know, anything like that you'd be willing to share?
I do. I kind of, my family went through hell with the Vietnam War. I was not in the war, but my two brothers, the family's never been the same and never will be. So it was shattering in that regard. And then other people I knew. So I was a teenager in 1968 in Spokane, Washington, the year we thought America would end. Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy shot and killed, and the Tet Offensive and the riots in the streets. And so that year ended with something magical. Apollo 8 went to the moon, went around the backside of the moon, and as the Earth reappeared from the backside of the moon, they took photographs of Earthrise over the sterile lunar surface. And when everybody saw their home as they never had before. And it showed me something. It showed me that in the midst of a very dark time, magic can happen and turn many things around. 2 years after that, we had our first Earth Day. Shortly after that, we had the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the National Environmental Protection Act, NEPA Policy Act. We had the Endangered Species Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, all under the Nixon administration. And on the heels of a very dark year for America, and I wanted to try to recreate that in this book, told in a community sort of a way, that the most unlikely of things can happen. People's coming together, school children and veterans, to form an alliance to stop a road building and a bridge for reasons they can't really point to. You can always say, oh, this creates jobs. That's the tangible. It puts money in his pocket. But there's other forms of wealth that are intangible. So It's the intangibles going up against the tangible, and that's really a provocative thing to write about.
Yeah.
And create a feisty kid to sort of show a young girl becoming a leader.
And hopefully inspiring this next generation, perhaps.
Yes.
I don't want people to think that, you know, everything, you're constantly just bashing people over the heads with a topic you're passionate about. But, you know, how important is humor when dealing with some of these, you know, more serious overall topics, that it's all gloom and doom, Armageddon, I guess, sometimes?
Humor is really important. Joy and humor. So I create lots of situations where humor can be expressed in the book. And what's really fun, for example, you'll just have discussions between two of the veterans who can be really funny guys. Or maybe it's chili night, Friday night moose chili night at Willy Nillyville, because this little compound where they all live that Uncle Ty created, it's called Willy Nillyville because there's no building codes, there's no covenants, there's no zoning. You just build willy nilly. So there are a bunch of these Tyvek wrapped buildings. They're not fully finished yet, no siding on them yet. So every Friday night is poker night, and they eat moose chili. And Kes is in her upstairs bedroom, and she can hear them down there. And they're laughing and they're talking. And what's really fun about this is I can create a waterfall of dialogue where, you know, EJ says this, then Captain Don says that. And then I can write, that sure got the discussion going. And then I can just have all these lines, many of them funny, with no dialogue tags. I don't have to have da-da-da-da-da-da, so-and-so said. It's just da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
And it's just this waterfall of dialogue, much of it funny. Well, somebody's going to have to sleep with the chickens. They hear the wolves. Somebody's going to have to sleep with the chickens tonight.
Yeah.
Not me. I slept with them last night.
Yeah.
Hey, we got cards on the table right now. Let's finish this hand. Yeah, let's finish this hand. I got five of a kind. You know, so just fun stuff like that, right?
Kind of real moments, too.
Real
probably.
Moments, absolutely. Yeah. The book's not all doom and gloom. It's there's a lot of humor, and there's music all the way through it because of Danny and his trauma coming out of his trauma and becoming a musician again with friends that Kes has made in town who bring over their guitars. She has her ukulele.
So I see you're also a musician. What role does music play in your personal life?
Oh, music's a huge part of my life. I'll bet I have 30% more friends in my life because of music. It's a big part of my life. I have been a musician for more than 50 years. I play guitar and keyboard. I often perform at the Alaska Folk Fest in Juneau every April. And it just colors everything, too. It colors my writing. I like to find musicality in words, the cadence of a sentence, right? And then in the story, in the novel, just there's now and then there are discussions about music that are interesting. Like at one point, there's a young guitarist who's a friend of Kestrel's named Tim. And he says, he's talking to Kes and he says, well, that song, Bird in a Cloud or something that your papa has, I love that. It's G to C and G to C and then D. But then it gets bluesy somehow. And Kes says, well, right, it goes B flat to A minor. That's where the blues comes in, because B flat is the minor third of G. She doesn't say that, but, and Tim goes, oh my goodness. So I don't dwell on that stuff, but it's just fun to have it within the dialogue. It gives it authenticity.
Yeah. Like a real conversation these two players would be talking about.
Right. Tim goes, you're playing in G and going to C, which is the four chord, makes perfect sense. Country music, you know, ba-da-da, ba-da, ba-da-da, and then find the D chord, which is the five chord, 1-4-5, 1-4-5, and then go to B flat. That's where the blues comes in. Because, you know, it's just really cool. And Tim is just blown away. He goes, oh, wow.
And I'm sure it just goes back to, you know, writing what you know, writing what you're familiar with, what you're passionate about.
Exactly. I just love to put it in there just to create a little authenticity, to let the reader know that Kes is keen on music. She's not the musician her father is, but she's inspired by his dad. You know, before he joined the National Guard in Texas and got shipped off to Afghanistan, he had his own band, his own recording contract. They'd travel by bus every summer, and she'd sometimes get to go up into Oklahoma and Kansas, over to New Mexico, stopping for roadside chilies, playing a concert that night. What a great thing for a little kid to get to be able to be a part of, to be on the bus.
Totally. And then one decision, maybe pressured by his dad.
Yeah, his dad said
his whole life.
Well, his dad was a Vietnam veteran, very proud. They've all served in wars. They're a proud, patriotic family. He says, just National Guard. It's 1 weekend a month, you know.
What's the worst that'll happen?
And he's always hurting for money. He's a musician. They're always hurting for money. And then he gets shipped off to Afghanistan, and everything changes.
Yeah, and I believe his older brother called the situation before it even happened.
He did. He said, don't do that. Don't join the National Guard. It's crazy right now. You're not going to. It doesn't mean you're going to be stacking sandbags along a flooding river. You could get shipped overseas and find yourself in a really dicey situation.
To start wrapping up the conversation, you know, I feel like every time I complete a project or, you know, any other creatives get something done that was, you know, meaningful to them, did the process of writing or completing this most recent book leave a lasting impression on you?
It did. It made me appreciate veterans and what they must have to go through after serving in a war. That was one of the biggest things that came from it. Made me appreciate just the long history of the persecution of wolves and what they've gone through. That itself is a war. The longest running war of all, in many respects, is the war of humanity against the natural world.
Yeah.
Just dicing and slicing it up everywhere. So, yeah, it was a profound experience to write this book and to revise it and revise it again. It took 7 years.
Oh.
Yes.
Must be a relief to have it out into the public.
It is. It's gotten nice reception, and I think it has something important to say. And today, and it has something important to say for where we find ourselves today.
Yeah. Obviously, we talk about all these, you know, serious topics, effect of war, you know, losing public lands, species dying out. But is there, do you feel like you have a hopeful outlook on things, or where do you kind of stand on that?
I do. Because I went through 1968 as a 17-year-old boy, and many people then thought America was going to end that year. I mean, you take some of our brightest leaders like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and then Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who was probably on his way to win the presidential race. He was both shot dead in the Tet Offensive. And the Vietnam War, just, will it ever end? What are we doing over there? Like, and we came out of that in ways that surprised everybody, I think, that we couldn't predict. So I never want to lose hope. I think it is my job as a writer, as a communicator, to give people hope, not false hope.
Mm.
I also have to let people know what we're up against, like with the climate crisis, which is very real and has been denied publicly and danced around awkwardly for so long because they just can't handle the scientific truth of it all. So it's my job to lay it all out there, but to give people hope. Despair, our greatest adversary, I believe, is despair. If we surrender to despair, then we've lost our joy. We've lost our, maybe our kindness. maybe our generosity. And we can't lose that. So, and we're a complex species capable of outrageous things. So I like to stand in the darkness and shine a light in the darkness, right? To write to the light, I call it. Step into the darkness and write to the light.
Somebody's got to push back against the encroaching dark, right?
Yeah, I think of myself as being in a dark room. And at the bottom of the door, I see a sliver of light. There's light out there. I just need to crack that door open for myself and for others.
Yeah.
And that requires a lot of creativity and positive thinking. It's not always easy, right? But I feel it's not only my right in a free country, but it's my responsibility to write to democracy, to write to a healthy planet, to describe what they are and what they need to be and where we find our rightful place there. Because I visited the Soviet Union when it was a Soviet Union. I went to Bulgaria, Romania, Ukraine when they were all behind the Iron Curtain. I met people that had been thrown in gulags, not just for writing leftist pamphlets, but for distributing them. 3 years in a gulag. They showed me the scars on their backs. So I am privileged to be able to write to these issues. And so I take it seriously and try to do my very best job.
Well, that might be a good way to start wrapping it up. This has been such a fantastic conversation. I've really enjoyed speaking with you. Is there anything else maybe you'd want to add about the book? Anything coming up? Maybe even your other writings in The Guardian, if anything, you want to mention that at all?
I'll be writing as much as I can for The Guardian in 2024, building up to the November elections, which are really important for the fate of not only democracy in America, but the fate of the health of our planet. I have no more books coming out soon. I have a couple in the works, but this book was 7 years in the making. It's somewhat of a sister book to my 2015 novel, Jimmy Bluefeather, that won the National Outdoor Book Award. I would just encourage people to read it if they want to contact me through my website, kimhecox.com, and I'll answer their questions. I appreciate being here. Thank you so much.
Now here is Kim Hecox reading from his recent novel, On Heaven's Hill.
As pastel evening light plays over the rooftops and trees and fireweed seeds drift about, catching the last light breaking, it occurs to Kes that you have to invent words for the way beauty expresses itself in Alaska. She remembers a similar evening from 1 year before, soon after she'd arrived in Strawberry Flats, when Uncle Ty told her that while the land is young and shaped mostly by glaciers, the processes are timeless, the rivers and tides, the seasons, the abundant life flowing and ebbing, the people rounded by water yet sharpened by ice, engaged in the country and committed to its flourishing. All in all, he said, it's a fine place to stand upon and defend. The other day, Zorro surprised Kes by inviting her to join him and Papa and Uncle Ty for a week of fishing on the Cinnamon Girl, their boat, before school begins. If indeed she'll go to Strawberry Flats Public School this year, it all depends on Mrs. Cunningham, the school board, and district superintendent. If they say no to Science Friday and Science Every Day, the Knights of the Menzies River will probably boycott. And as for fishing, Uncle Ty says they'll longline in Chatham Strait. It'll be hard work, but we'll poke around the north shore of Chichagof to study coastal brownies and humpback whales and sea otters. After that, who knows? We might head up into Crystal Bay for a couple days, anchor in rock-ribbed inlets, and hang out with harbor seals, kittiwakes, and tidewater glaciers. Sing with loons, dance with storms, put glacial ice on our drinks, and slurp down the Pleistocene, the Ice Age. How does that sound? That night, Kes was so excited, she jammed with Papa until 1 o'clock in the morning and talked about family in Mexico, her birth mom's family, my family, and heard so many life-affirming stories from Papa that afterwards she could hardly sleep. Slurping down the Pleistocene, wow. When she told Uncle Ty the next day, he chuckled, "It all used to be under one big glacier, my young apprentice, an icy sarcophagus. And now look how alive the land is, with wild strawberries growing out of solid granite, and moose swimming fjords, and wolves crossing ice fields. It's a land and sea of rebirth, a renaissance place, And if you stay here long enough and let it speak to you and learn to listen, you'll be reborn too.
That was author Kim Hecox from Gustavus. His novel On Heaven's Hill is available now. And that's all the time we have for you today. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org, the Alaska Public Media app, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Ammon Swenson. Thanks for listening.
State of Art is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed are those of the hosts and participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Theme music is Spring Breakup by Termination Dust. Get in touch with the host by sending an email to soa@alaskapublic.org.